the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning, we speak with astronomer Phil Plait, who introduces his new book, Under Alien Skies. Plait has worked as part of the Hubble Space Telescope team, as well as engaging in public outreach advocacy for NASA missions, and has an upcoming talk tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Clark Planetarium in Salt Lake.
Then, when you think of NASA, you may think of mighty rockets, rovers, and astronauts. What you may not realize is that NASA is the home to the largest group of Earth scientists in the world. Our colleague John Wells speaks with NASA climate scientist Dr. Leslie Ott. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This Friday, May 5th at 7 p.m. at Clark Planetarium in Salt Lake, astronomer and renowned science communicator Dr. Philip Plait visits to give a lecture based on his new book, Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. What would it be like to sail above Saturn's rings or watch an eclipse from the moon, or stare in awe as sunset brings a million brilliant stars to the sky of a planet in a star cluster? Well, Dr. Phil Plait joins us now to preview his talk and his new book. Phil, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We're really excited to have you on, and especially to preview this talk. It's the 20th anniversary gala of the Clark Planetarium, and you said you were here last time 10 years ago for the 10th anniversary. Why do you like coming back to Clark Planetarium?
Well, apparently I don't like it that much if I'm waiting 10 years, but no, in fact, it's a magnificent planetarium. When I first went, I wasn't sure what to expect. I've been to a lot of places like that, but it was so much better than I expected. It was enormous with so many cool exhibits. The planetarium itself was wonderful. The people there are great. And anybody who lives in the city should really carve out time to come visit it. Whether, hey, it's to come see me talk, go to the gala over the weekend, or just to, you know, have a good time and see what's there, because it really is cool.
And King's English Bookstore will be there beginning at 5:30 p.m. on Friday. Again, your talk begins at 7. They will be there to sell, and you'll sign after the presentation copies of your new book, Under Alien Skies. Let's get into this book a little bit. Fun, it's informative, and it's kind of been launched from what you do as an astronomer and a science communicator. Why did you go into it the way you did?
The book, anytime I write something, it's something I'd want to read. And I am pretty passionate about astronomy and space exploration. And this is the kind of book I would have loved to have read when I was a kid, because I love science fiction, I love science, and I want to think about what it's like to actually be at these places that I see through the eyepiece, or that I see Hubble Space Telescope images of. And in fact, when I give talks or show people images like that, they usually ask me, you know, what would these things look like if you were there? And it's a natural question, but it's not always easy to answer. And the answer sometimes is, hey, pretty much what you see in the picture. And other times, well, it would look nothing like this, because you're using a digital camera on a telescope in space, which works very differently than our eyes do. This book is to take the reader to these places, not just to have me sit there and say, oh, Saturn has rings and they look like this. It's more like, let's come along together and I'll show you what this looks like, and you'll experience what it's like to travel to these places and see what it is to actually be there.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking to Phil Plait, author of Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. Well, Phil, I think another great title for this book would be, instead of Lonely Planet, Lonely Galaxy, because it truly is a travel guide for the universe.
you know, everyone's fantasy with how to see Saturn's rings and globular clusters. What was it that inspired you to turn this into such an accessible travel guide?
I wouldn't say that I was inspired to do that necessarily. I did write articles about this back in Astronomy Magazine back in 2003, so 20 years ago. It's been a long time coming. And it was an idea I had from talking to people and, like I said, showing people these things through the telescope and them asking me, you know, what would it be like? So that was the inspiration for the book. But I've been doing this for a long time. It's weird to even think that I've been doing this for like 30 years. But taking people outside, showing them the sky, writing about it, going on TV, talking about it, sometimes being on the radio and telling them about things like that. And I've never wanted to make this seem like, pardon the expression, it's over anybody's head. I mean, it's literally over everybody's head. But a lot of this stuff is understandable. Some of it isn't. You know, black holes are confusing and scientists don't really understand everything about them either. But a lot of the stuff you can think about is standing on the moon. What would that be like? And I really, really love astronomy and I really love sharing that passion with people. So sitting down and writing a book, showing them what it would be like if they were there, if they were in, you know, the place of my imagination where I've imagined myself all these decades, that was super easy to sit down and do.
Yeah, reading through it, it was such a great immersive experience to understand really what it would be like to be hovering over the rings of Saturn and on a planet within a set of, you know, within a globular cluster. And thank you for including Pluto. Pluto has gotten the shaft for so many years. With this sequence of adventures that you go on, how was it that you chose where to go? Because it's a big galaxy out there and there's got to be a lot of really cool things to see. So how did you narrow down the stops?
Painfully, actually. I mean, it's a whole universe by definition. It's everything. And so choosing a few things, some things were easy. I start at the moon. People are at least a little bit familiar with the moon. We've seen the Apollo videos and you can look up and see the moon. Going out from there, Mars was a fairly obvious second chapter because NASA's really focused on Mars right now. We're sending a lot of probes there. We want to send people there. And then after that, it got a little trickier. Saturn, I mean, come on, it's Saturn. It's just the coolest planet in the solar system. And Pluto was sort of the last guardian, the sentinel of the solar system. It's the last large object that we've seen up close out there. And if you don't think Pluto's a planet, and I'm fine with that, and we can argue about what a planet is, it's more difficult to say, you know, you're visiting Neptune. After Saturn, I mean, Neptune's super cool. It's a good planet, don't get me wrong, but I wouldn't be able to add enough new stuff. So Pluto became my pick. And I wanted to pick things that I really liked looking at through a telescope. So a nebula, which is a gas cloud. A lot of these are forming stars. Some of them form around dying stars. And I studied these for my master's degree and my PhD. So I had to do that. Globular clusters are these compact collections of hundreds of thousands or over a million stars in a relatively small volume. And in the same volume of space near the sun, there are a few dozen stars. And inside a cluster, there are 100,000 or more. So that would be truly spectacular. And they're so cool to look at through a telescope. So again, easy pick. But after that, it was more like, you know, what's neat? What do I like? What am I interested in? And having a planet orbiting more than one star, I can pretty confidently assume that most people have seen the original Star Wars movie. And there's the scene where Luke is standing outside of the huts and he's looking at the twin suns setting. And it turns out, yes, Tatooine in those movies is orbiting a binary star. And that scene, they got it right. It's pretty good. That scene is fairly accurate. But there's a lot more about having a planet around those kind of stars. And in fact, and this is the part that every time I think about it, and as many times as I've thought about it, it still blows me away. We know of planets like this. Hundreds of planets have been found orbiting multiple stars, either two, three, four star systems, or one star in, say, a binary star system. So you'd have like one sun in your sky and then a second farther away sun that would also affect what you see. And so sitting down and figuring all that out, that's too irresistible of a puzzle. I had to do it.
I love it. And talk to us a little bit about the uniqueness of the Earth having just one sun.
It's a little tricky to think about this. Now, we have one star that our planet orbits. We have multiple planets orbiting a single star, the sun. And it turns out that when you look at all the stars in the sky, half something like that are actually in multiple star systems and half are not. So it's kind of a coin toss. It's not exactly half, but it's close. And it turns out it's more complicated than that. When you have bigger stars, a lot of people say the sun is an average star. That's not really true. It's actually in the on the bigger end of stars. Those stars tend to be single, tend to be in multiple star systems. But the lower mass stars, like ones we call red dwarfs, and these are half the mass and size of the sun or cooler, they're not very hot, they're not very bright, not a single one is visible to the naked eye, and yet they're the most common star in the galaxy. There are hundreds of billions of these things. They tend to be single stars. And so it's interesting that there's this segregation between high mass stars and low mass stars. But a planet orbiting one of these little red dwarf stars would have a very different sight in their sky than we do. So visiting one of them, it sounds at first like, oh, it's just a red dwarf star. You've just got this faint star in your sky. And it turns out, no, it's actually really different and really cool. And there's a lot of interesting science going on. The other planets in that system, what we're seeing, especially the one star I wrote about in the book, TRAPPIST-1, which is a real star, has seven known planets orbiting it, all of which are roughly the same size as Earth. And as far as we can tell, they're probably rocky worlds like Earth is. We don't know if they have atmospheres, we don't know if they have water. Three of them are orbiting the right distance from that star to have an Earth-like temperature, but that's all we know. So I pretend, let's say one of these planets is Earth-like and we go visit it. Some of these other planets, you'll be able to see them in the sky as disks, like the moon in the sky. They're not just points of light like all the other planets are in our solar system. So you get to have this tremendous view, and they orbit the star very quickly. So you could stand there for a few minutes and watch them move in the sky. Just seeing that red swollen star sitting there, even though the star is small, you have to be very close to it to be warm. So I got to write about how planets orbit stars, how their temperature depends on their distance from the star, and what weather would be like on a planet like that. We can make some fairly intelligent guesses about that. Turning that into sort of a science fiction story, you are on this planet, what do you experience, was like a dream come true for me. I love science fiction, and being able to write science-inspired science fiction in this way was so much fun.
Science-inspired science fiction. I love it. I love it. And there is this bridge between science fiction and science. You're often hired, as I understand, to consult for movies and things like that that are science fiction, that are dealing with the cosmos and space. And it's all part of this other persona that you have, in addition to being a lecturer and a writer. And it is this thing called Dr. Philip Plait, the bad astronomer. Tell us about the origin of that. I know that it's not because you're actually a bad astronomer, it's that you're correcting bad astronomy.
It depends on who you talk to, but yes, a lot of folks don't necessarily like what I have to say because they may have beliefs that are not based in science, and I can come in and say, well, so if you think the Earth is flat or the Apollo landings never happened, I may have one or two things to say to you. But yeah, back in the 1990s, when the internet was brand new, I started writing about myths and misconceptions in astronomy. And it was fun, actually, to sort of take these common mistaken beliefs and write about the real science of them. And sometimes it wasn't obvious, like why the moon looks big on the horizon. And a lot of people think, well, the atmosphere acts like a lens making it bigger. And it turns out, no, it's actually a combination of a couple of different illusions about how we perceive the sky over our head. We don't perceive it as like a dome. It's more like a flattened dome. And that's at least the way we see it. And that tricks our brain into thinking that things on the horizon are farther away than they really are. And that actually winds up making the moon look bigger because your brain's expecting it to be smaller and it's not. So your brain thinks, ah, it's too big. So to dive into the psychology of that, into illusions and the astronomy and even a little tiny bit of trigonometry that you have to kind of delve into to figure this stuff out was so much fun. And all of these misconceptions really, they span a huge range of science. Any scientist in any field has their list of things that people get wrong. And it was fun to debunk them basically, or at least use them as a way to talk about the real science. So yeah, you're right. I was talking about bad astronomy. People started calling me the bad astronomer. I got a kick out of the name and it has stuck. I mean, it's been 30 years and here we are. I'm still using it.
Well, as a bad astronomer, you've written a great book.
Thank you.
So with each stop, how did you decide what to highlight? It'd be like going to Paris and picking out three things to choose, because I can imagine there's got to be so many fascinating things about landing on an asteroid or visiting Pluto or a binary star system. How did you decide what was going to be the highlight of the trip?
Well, it's funny you'd pick those examples, because in fact, for a lot of these places, we've only visited them by spacecraft. And so, for example, Pluto. Pluto has an interesting history, its discovery, how it was originally thought to be really big, maybe the size of the Earth, but as the time went by and we realized it was actually much smaller. Then the whole argument over whether it's a planet or not. And we've only visited it with one spacecraft that flew past it at such high speed that whole encounter really only lasted a couple of days. And the close-up shots that we got of Pluto occurred over just a few hours. So picking what to talk about on Pluto turned out to be easy, because we've only seen a few things on it. So I wound up taking some time and writing about the history, writing about its weird moon, Charon. So that was relatively easy. When it came to Saturn, on the other hand, that chapter was threatening to take over half the book, and it could have easily have been twice as long. I was constantly cutting stuff out. And in fact, the talk I'm giving at the planetarium is Saturn-based. I basically took that chapter and turned it into a talk. And as I was putting the talk together, I kept going, yeah, nope, can't talk about that. No time. It was putting the whole thing together and then ripping slides out, you know, tearfully, like, no, I can't do that one either. So choosing for that was a lot more difficult. I had to leave some stuff out even in the book, either because it was super complicated or Saturn has a zillion moons and each one could be a chapter. So it had to get pared down quite a lot, actually. And it was difficult. It wasn't much fun to have to yank whole sections out, but there you go.
Yeah. Well, the kind of the opposite of paring down has got to be the amount of research you had to do. There were so many, and there were so many new variables, maybe some inferences that you had to make. Where did you get the data and the information to create what it would be like on a planet within a globular cluster?
Well, that one's based on science. We have been studying globular clusters for decades, centuries. And in the past few decades, we've learned a tremendous amount about them, which is pretty much true of anything in astronomy. You could just insert noun, you know, astronomical noun here, and then the rest of the sentences. And, you know, since Hubble, we've learned this. When I was a kid, we didn't know that much about them. They weren't thought to be that interesting of an object, a globular cluster. And then we started learning, oh, they're very old, and we knew that, but we always thought that all the stars were the same age. And then it turns out, no, there are multiple populations of stars in some of these things, and not all of them are globular clusters. Some of them look just like globular clusters. They're these spherical, they look like beehives made of stars. They're super cool. But some of them may be the cores of galaxies that got eaten by our galaxy, tore all the outer parts off and left the core behind. And that looks just like a globular cluster. So there's all sorts of wild stuff that we have learned in just the past 15 years. So I read a lot of papers. I did a lot of math. I mean, you have to know that certain kinds of stars are bright and some aren't. What kinds of stars are bright? Why do some of them look blue? Why do some of them look red? And how that would look, as well as the fact that planets in globular clusters, we don't even know if they exist. There's one star in a globular that we know has a planet, but we expect to see a lot more. You know, why don't we see them? Well, it may be that globular clusters are so old that they couldn't form planets when they formed. There weren't enough heavy elements in the universe. The universe had like hydrogen and helium and a handful of other stuff. There just wasn't a lot of iron and silicon and oxygen to make planets like Earth. So, you know, that's what we're talking about here, stuff that is really touching on a lot of fields of astronomy that I had to kind of put together and then actually do a lot of math. The TRAPPIST-1, the red dwarf system, had a lot of math figuring out how big these planets would look and what temperatures they would be. And the one about orbiting a binary star had to do a lot of math for that, because the temperature can be wildly different on a planet. I had to figure out how far it had to be from a star to be habitable. And I don't put any of that in the book. You'll just read a paragraph in a chapter, and then and I'll say, and yes, and here's 20 pages of algebra that I had to do to get that one sentence in that paragraph. So I tried to hide all the math and make it a little bit easier on the reader and just hand them the results.
Thanks for that.
I love it. Okay, since there's so much focus on the moon with the Artemis mission taking shape, last year Artemis 1 was underway. We have another, I think, 2 years before in 2024, or no, next year, 2024. I'm losing my years here.
It'll be 2 years.
Okay.
It'll be delayed. Don't worry about that. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about going to the moon and what we would see if we were on the moon. And sort of, I understand with Artemis, there's going to be sort of this development happening, this pre-staging going on for Artemis 2, 3, 4. But looking back at Earth, we see a sunrise, we see a sunset here on Earth, we see the moon rise, we see the moon set. How wild and wonderful would it be to see an Earth rise and an Earth set? What's that going to look like?
That was actually one of the most interesting parts for me about writing that chapter. We know a lot about the moon, and one thing that is pretty obvious once you study it for any length of time is that it always shows the same face towards Earth. It spins once for every time it goes around the Earth. And that is a natural product of the way gravity works. And all the moons in the solar system, all the big moons at least, do that same thing. They orbit their planets once for every time they spin and always show the same face. So for us on Earth, we look up at the moon, and if you look at it now or 100 years from now, you're going to see pretty much the same part of the moon. But on the moon, that means that if you're standing there and looking up, you'll see the Earth in the sky. And right away, that's super cool, because the Earth will be 4 times bigger than the full moon. It'll undergo phases just like the moon does, but it'll be blue and white and green, all these lovely colors, which you don't get on the moon. The moon's basically gray. That would be incredibly beautiful. And it's like 50 times brighter than the moon in our sky. So it would really light up everything. But because the moon spins at the same rate it orbits, you'd think that the Earth would be in one spot in the sky and would not move. That's the way that geometry works out. But it turns out it's not that simple. The moon orbits the Earth on an ellipse, and that ellipse is tilted a little bit to the Earth. So the way it works out, because of perspective, we can sometimes see a little bit around onto the far side on the right, and other times a little bit to the far side on the left, and above and below. So we can actually see more than 50% of the moon. And what that means is, as the moon is sort of rocking back and forth in its orbit, on the moon, you would see the Earth move a little bit. And I figured, okay, it's gonna move a little bit, probably not very much. And it turns out, no, it moves a lot. And it doesn't really rise and set necessarily, but it's not nailed to the sky in one spot. And if you were on the what we would call the edge of the moon, that line between the near and the far side, you would see the Earth rise and set once a month. It takes the moon a month to go around the Earth. So, you know, a daytime is 2 weeks long, nighttime is 2 weeks long, and you could actually see the Earth sort of rise up above the horizon and then not get very high up and then turn around and set again over the course of several days. And I think that would be especially when it's right on the horizon, like being split in two by the moon's horizon, that would be, I think, worth the price of the ticket.
Absolutely. Well, and to hear you talk about it, I just have to ask you this question, Phil. When you are giving a talk or presentation to an audience, no doubt there are lots of young people in the audience. There are their parents that come along. And I'm wondering about, you turn people on to this, you know, to talking about space and talking about planets and exoplanets and red dwarfs and globular clusters and everything. What is the look on an adult's face when you have inspired them versus what a little kid does who's already excited about this stuff?
That's an interesting question. And the answer is there's no difference. First of all, when you're talking about something you love, you get passionate about it. And that draws people in. And I can't help but stand up there and get very excited. And especially when somebody asks me something that I haven't thought about, or it's clear that they're thinking about it, they're curious and their imagination is going. So, you know, that's very engaging. But I found that, yeah, the kids are super excited about this sort of thing, but the adults, especially the ones who didn't know how much this stuff would be cool to them. And everybody loves a good picture of Saturn. That's what I'm gonna be showing everybody. So I see sort of the same sort of, you know, gape, the wide-eyed stare of, oh my God. What's obvious to me, because I've been studying this for so long, is not at all obvious to somebody who has maybe seen a picture of Saturn or two. So when I'm talking about some of the weird moons and show them pictures and I say, so what would that look like? And then click to the next picture and there it is. It's so much fun to turn to the audience and see so many people go, oh, and you get that gasp. There's nothing like showing people Saturn through a telescope. Unfortunately, Saturn's not up right now. It's on the other side of the sun, so we can't really see it. But when anybody who has never seen Saturn looks through an eyepiece and sees it as this perfect little disc surrounded by those rings, and you can just see it, it's obvious. The delight, the gasp, the oh my God, all of that, that's why I do this. It's pretty amazing. And to be able to introduce somebody to that feeling never gets old. And it's kid and adult alike.
I bet. Well, it's good to know there's still hope for us as adults, right? As grownups.
It's easy to be cynical, but sometimes it's easy to lose that cynicism as well.
I love it. Well, the book is Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe. Our guest is Dr. Philip Plate. He will be at Clark Planetarium to help them celebrate their 20th anniversary this Friday, May 5th. At 7 p.m., there are still tickets remaining, but they will sell out. So you better go online right now and get them. Thank you, Phil, so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. When you think about NASA, well, you may think about these mighty rockets, rovers, and astronauts, but what you may not realize is that NASA is the home to the largest group of Earth scientists in the world. NASA's fleet of more than 25 Earth-observing satellites helps the agency understand our home planet by continuously monitoring critical issues such as climate change, wildfires, and air quality. Joining us now is Dr. Leslie Ott, a NASA client scientist with 20 years' experience studying air pollution and greenhouse gases. Leslie, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're delighted to have you with us this morning. And being an Earth scientist, share with us just a little bit about what we've learned about our planet lately.
You know, there's things that I take for granted. I started school, you know, in the 90s and was going through in the 2000s. Some of the imagery that we've seen that we take for granted, you know, the blue marble, those iconic images of vegetation, of clouds, all of those beautiful global views of the planet have come in recent decades. And some of the advances we've made at NASA and through partner agencies in the US government have allowed us to understand and the baseline of the planet and how that's changing now, being able to track that over multiple decades. So that's really critical for understanding how climate change is progressing. And I think the other things we're learning from satellites is how interconnected the planet is. You know, when it used to be in the 80s and 90s, scientists would study the atmosphere or they'd study the ocean, but it was almost like they were all separate things. And the view from space and that global perspective has really allowed us to understand how the Earth functions as this very complex, very delicate, interconnected system. And I think that's the thing that I marvel at and appreciate, and I'm grateful to get to study every day.
And we have interviewed a number of astronauts over the years, including a live interview with astronauts on the International Space Station when it was traveling, I don't know, 17,500 miles per hour, 270 miles above the planet. Every single astronaut that we speak to, and we talk to them about the blue ribbon, and when they see how fragile the atmosphere is, how small the atmosphere is, and as they spend that time up there observing the planet, every single one of them says something like, the planet is alive. It's a single organism. And it's something that I would like to see shared with everybody. I mean, everybody has access to the same videos and everything, but if you could imagine being up in space and looking at this spectacular planet, it is alive. And it is fragile, and we need to take care of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to me, you know, a lot of my work these days focuses on greenhouse gas, and that includes human emissions, but also the carbon sinks that are really saving us from climate change progressing more quickly, right? That the land and the oceans absorbing carbon dioxide. And when you study a system, you're forced to look at the incredible connections and complexity of the way that, you know, carbon feeds plants, the way that land carbon is connected to the oceans through rivers and through these complex transport processes, how nutrients feed phytoplankton, who also absorb carbon from the atmosphere, and how all of that is connected to our human activities, right, of producing greenhouse gases to sustain our lifestyle, to produce energy. And you realize, you know, that those connections are very difficult. It's very challenging to study them, but you can't help but think about how interconnected all those things are. And really, we can't have solutions until we understand and appreciate all of those kinds of complex connections.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Leslie Ott. She is a NASA scientist with 20 years experience studying air pollution and greenhouse gases. She received her PhD in atmospheric science from my alma mater, the University of Maryland in College Park, and she's been working at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, I assume in Greenbelt, Maryland, ever since.
Yes, correct. I didn't know. Good to see the Maryland connection.
Yeah, we got to keep those terps in science, don't we?
We absolutely do. Absolutely. And it's great. I, you know, these days I see so many Maryland alumni, and it's really nice to see all of the connections and all of the places that my colleagues have gone in their careers.
Well, I went to school at a different time you did. I went to school before electricity. So, you know, it was a while ago.
I don't think, probably not quite that long.
So you currently lead the carbon group with the Global Modeling and Assimilation Office. Tell us about that job, about that part of your job.
Yeah, it's a really interesting group within NASA. So NASA has, in addition to our fleet of satellites, some of the most complex Earth system models in the world. And we use those models to do things like project how climate is changing, and also to understand the current period of the planet by integrating all kinds of satellite data with a model field. Scientists call that data assimilation. It's basically a lot of math, but what that does is give us the best understanding of tying all of the different observations of the planet that we have together to create a baseline understanding of current weather and climate. And within that group, within the Global Modeling and Assimilation Office, our group is really focused on understanding the carbon cycle processes and greenhouse gases. So we're working to create very complex, very detailed models of the exchange of carbon dioxide between land ecosystems and the atmosphere, between ocean and the atmosphere, to model human emissions, to be able to do all of those things in near real time. We're not quite there yet, but it used to be that those processes were so complex, it would take scientists years after the fact to be able to model them. And now we're trying to get that down to months so we can provide the public data in something close to real time, so people can see how greenhouse gases are changing all around them. And we started to, during COVID, we started to do this, you know, with a couple of months delay, because people started to ask, how is COVID changing greenhouse gases? Does this mean climate change is over? Unfortunately, it didn't. But we could give those kinds of answers to the public much more quickly than we could before, largely because of this convergence of high-end computing, of satellites and modeling. And so that's really where we sit and where most of our work focuses.
So as you do your job, you use technology and you use hardware, software, there's the models, the algorithms. Where's the most bang for the buck these days? I mean, of course, we can push the silicon and we can get more performant computers on the hardware side. We can get more efficient software. But these models that you are building, is that where the possibilities lie?
I think so. And, you know, you need all of the ingredients, right? You need the observations to tell you what the truth is, but you're always going to need a model to integrate different types of observations. So for example, you know, one of the things that policymakers need to understand is the exchange of molecules of carbon dioxide between the atmosphere and the land surface. But we can't measure that exchange directly from satellites. What we do is measure a lot of the parameters that are relevant. So we'll measure the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We'll measure how productive ecosystems are. We can even measure nighttime lights to see where energy is being consumed. But what we have to do is translate and tie all those pieces together in models to be able to get the exact quantities that people need to make decisions. And I think really, I would say, yeah, it's as we get more and more pieces of information, that's great, but that means there's an increasing need for these kinds of very complex models. And I think the other place where there's a lot of opportunity and progress being made is breaking down these kind of disciplined stovepipes that we used to have. Again, it used to be that the atmospheric models only handled the atmosphere, and it was like the land and the ocean didn't move, right? They just sat there and did something static. And increasingly, we're trying to have models where those complex interactions are better represented. So that's the real goal. And that helps us both understand the current period. It also helps us make better predictions of the future when we have more realism in how those processes are all tied together. And so that's where there's a lot of energy right now is making the models better, delivering things more quickly, and also making them more complete. So instead of having a box of, you know, three or four different components that are all stitched together, that you've got one cohesive model. That's a big ask. That's going to be something that keeps us busy for a number of years, but it's also incredibly exciting because we're getting closer to this goal that we've had for, you know, really decades, and we're starting to see that come to fruition.
And when you collect all this data and you release it to the public domain, and the policymakers of various countries and organizations use that data to try to structure different things for their constituents, what fascinates me is it's not just the policymakers, but you will give information that a farmer in Central America in a specific country, you'll be able to tell that farmer, listen, this area right here is the drought's going to continue. This is where you should plant your crops. I mean, there's a lot of detail that goes into this, and there's a lot of people that are helped by NASA.
Yeah. And this is an incredibly important, thank you so much for mentioning this, because this is an incredibly important part of our mission that I think a lot of people don't see or aren't aware of, is making sure, you know, yeah, we want to do science, we want to answer science questions, but we're not just doing that in an ivory tower so we can write fancy papers, right? We're doing this for, you know, the good of society. And another thing people should know is all NASA data is and has always been free and publicly available. That's something even when other countries come to visit, they say, how are you doing that? How has that been your model? They're catching up. But that's been a standard that I think the US should be really proud of making, you know, the best quality science data, making it free and publicly available, and also working really hard to make tools that make those data sets more accessible, right? We want that data to be easy to access, easy for somebody, a farmer or a firefighter, or somebody who doesn't have a supercomputer and a ton of computer programming background. We want people to be able to have the tools to access that data and get the most out of it. And so that's another area where, in addition to, you know, the satellites and the models that we develop, those tools to connect the data to end users is a really, really important and growing part of our mission.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Leslie Ott. She's a climate scientist with NASA. And in your 20 years of experience with NASA, what have you learned about climate change and climate science that has surprised you the most?
Oh, that's always a really good question. What has surprised me? I think, you know, one of the things, and I don't know if it's exactly surprise, you know, but I found it very gratifying and to be able to see over the course of that period some positive progress on the environment in the form of better air quality in the United States. That, of course, is something we had all hoped for and wanted to achieve with the Clean Air Act. But to actually see that demonstrated through being able to have satellite measurements of air quality pollutants over the U.S., being able to demonstrate how those are changing over time, there's a lot of technical achievements that go in. First, you've got to have a good quality satellite. You've got to maintain the satellite and make sure it's consistent over a long period. But, you know, some of the work that's been done over the past 5 to 10 years to be able to demonstrate, yes, we've made policies that have improved air quality. That's not necessarily a surprise. But it's something that's been incredibly gratifying. And to me, you know, there's times where people get really down about climate change, and for good reason. But those kinds of examples where we are seeing changes made and we have some hope, I think that's in some cases a little bit of a surprise, the good stories, right? I think I'm also, you know, constantly amazed at the detailed views we're seeing from some of the new sensors. I have a colleague who studies urban processes, urban heat island, and being able to actually see differences in land surface temperature in parts of cities that are forested versus not forested, in places where people are putting into place, you know, innovative climate mitigation measures like painting pavement white, seeing the actual on the ground details of how those kinds of actions at the city scale can improve urban environments. That's something that, again, you know, you would hope to be able to see from satellite, but I'm very much gratified that the current generation of sensors and the next generation are being able to give us even more detail at those kinds of scales.
Yeah, and with the new geographic information system degree programs in so many major universities today, they can take a lot of this data and a lot of these pictures, and they can put together products that would allow somebody to take a look at every roof that's over a million square feet that's black, that's configured a certain way in the southwest part of the country, and then be able to take that data and say, okay, now if we took these buildings and we painted them white, how would that affect what we're trying to accomplish? It's just fascinating to me. There's so many people that are working on this at NASA, but also outside of NASA because of all the data that you all provide.
Yeah. We even had it's funny you mentioned the roofs. We even had colleagues at NASA look at recovery after hurricanes, and they were able to track how fast recovery was progressing in poorer versus wealthier neighborhoods by how long you had blue tarps on the roofs. Because for some reason, everybody uses those blue tarps. They're not like any color in nature, and you could pick that out. But those kinds of really, the advances in the data, plus just the creativity of researchers, right? I would have never thought to use that blue color and say, hey, we can pick out the blue tarps. But how cool is that to be able to look and find these kinds of details in the data sets? It's really rich. And it's, again, you know, as you point out, something that benefits from having this huge community of researchers across the U.S. and really across the world, looking at all of this data that's out there now.
Yeah, and when you mentioned using the color white for roads, and I was just talking about roofs and things like that, I was speaking to a scientist from Jet Propulsion Laboratory who is involved in trying to understand new technology, different proposals that come through, and some group made a proposal, and they're looking at it very seriously, of being able to paint a asteroid white with a white powder, have this explosion that would throw white powder on one side of it, say on the sun side. And over time, as the sun is interacting with that asteroid, it could, you know, just slightly change that orbit for an asteroid that may be in the direction of Earth, for an example. So I thought that was interesting.
That's fascinating. I haven't heard that. I'm going to have to catch up with our colleagues at JPL, but that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I'm curious about this. There are many questions that you ask about climate change. That's your job, asking questions. Of all the questions that you have about climate change, what keeps you up at night? What one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
So one of the big questions we're working on that concerns me and everyone in my field is what's going to happen to our natural carbon sinks. So about 50% of human emissions of carbon dioxide, the most important greenhouse gas, are absorbed by plants on the land and by our oceans. So that's been the huge sort of saving grace of climate change. If we didn't have that assist from the natural world, we'd be seeing temperatures rise much more quickly than they are right now. So that's been an incredible buffer to climate change. But one of the greatest concerns that we have is whether or not that's going to continue as the planet warms, as you see certain ecosystems under more strain. And that's one of the reasons we're working so hard to understand what's happening right now so that we can improve climate models. But this is a very, this is one of the largest uncertainties that we have in climate projections over the next century. It's one of the biggest uncertainties, frankly, in our policymakers trying to set emissions targets, because really we're setting targets for what we're doing, but we don't know exactly what the forests and the oceans are going to do in coming years. And so I would say that's the one thing that, or, you know, one of several, but that's one thing that really concerns me, is making sure that we can improve our understanding of the natural sides of the carbon cycle so that we can improve those models and have more confidence that the actions we're taking are getting us where we want to go. That's one thing that I think is very pressing on my mind.
And I'm curious about, you know, when they talk about the weakest link will break the chain, what is that weakest link? I mean, if acidification of our oceans were to occur to the extent that we started losing plant life, and that plant life through photosynthesis is not able to act as the carbon sink that it used to, is that something that concerns us the most?
It's a really good question. And there's a number of pieces that I think we're tracking here. On the ocean, there's acidification and the impact that could have on marine plants and the marine food web, which also has its own consequences, right? Not just storing carbon, but supporting humans and our food needs. But also, you know, the response of warming and how that's affecting the ocean's ability to absorb carbon. That's a big question mark. Another wild card in all this that we don't understand very well is emissions of methane from wetlands. Some of these responses are temperature sensitive, right? And so one concern is that if you increase the temperature, which we know is happening, you know, do you have this feedback, this positive feedback loop where you're increasing the emissions of methane from wetlands? We don't understand that well enough right now. We also don't understand what's going on in high latitudes. In the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere, warming's progressing faster than anywhere else on the planet, about two to three times faster, depending on your estimate. And the fate of carbon-rich soils, stored as permafrost, we don't understand how that carbon could become vulnerable to release to the atmosphere and the impact that might have. So some of these feedbacks, I would say those are some of the weakest links, are those things that we don't have complete control over. It's hard to control our forests, but at least we can manage some of our landscapes. But some of these kinds of things, like coastal wetlands, open ocean processes, high latitudes, where it's very hard to have, you know, direct control just because of the placement and that, in some cases, the scope, right? How big are the oceans? Those are some of the things that I think are really challenging in both understanding and managing as we move forward.
Yeah, I can imagine the permafrost, if it is warming up quicker than we thought, that's something we need to really understand. How much carbon does the permafrost potentially hold?
It is quite a lot. It is, by different estimates, many, many more times than the carbon that is in the atmosphere. So some of the questions are, how much of that carbon is vulnerable to release to the atmosphere, and what form will that be? Will that be in the form of carbon dioxide or methane? It depends a little bit on whether it's coming from dry soils or wet soils. That's very important because carbon dioxide and methane have different global warming potentials. Methane as a molecule is more efficient at trapping heat, but there's a lot less of it in the atmosphere. So scientists need to understand not just how much carbon could be lost from some of those soils, but also what is the pathway that it gets into the atmosphere, because that affects how much warming there is going to be on the near versus long term.
And a final question, Dahlia Kirschbaum's been on the program a couple of times talking about the Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite and the constellation of satellites that it communicates with. As you look at new technology, or new satellites, which are on the drawing board, which have not gone up yet, what sort of value will they add to the constellation over the next 10 years?
Yeah, this is, you know, there's a lot of excitement about some of the new resources that are coming online. And one of the things that's interesting in the kind of work we do is, you know, NASA is no longer the only player in the game. And this is true of GPM and that constellation. That's an international collaboration with multiple satellites being stitched together. And as we get more mature in the greenhouse gas observations we make, that's increasingly true for us too. We have really exciting missions that are coming up from European partners, from Japanese partners. And those are going to be really, really impactful in expanding the amount of data that we get for greenhouse gases every day. There's going to be challenges, right, in terms of reconciling all these satellites are subtly different. You've got to stitch them together, and that means you've got to have a lot of ground sites for calibration and validation. You've got to have these models to sort of synthesize and understand the complete picture that no one satellite gives you alone. But, you know, satellite greenhouse gas observations are a fairly new game for NASA. We've been making observations of ozone for 40 years, but we've been making greenhouse gas measurements for under 10. And so the things that I think are exciting are really expanding that coverage so that we have that kind of global picture of greenhouse gases nearly every day. That's something that, you know, has I think been a dream for a long time. And over the next few years, that's going to become a reality. So for us, that's going to be a huge advance, and hopefully going to tell us a lot about some of the processes that we talked about today, about understanding our ecosystems, understanding ocean atmosphere exchange. So I think the real, for us, the real game changer in greenhouse gas measurements is getting that constellation that gives us near daily coverage of observations of carbon dioxide and methane. That's something we've dreamed of for a long time, and that's finally becoming a reality as we get this sort of international constellation in place. So that's going to give us the opportunity to observe greenhouse gases sort of the way that we do precipitation, the way that Dahlia's talked about GPM. And so that's something we're really, really excited about. So stay tuned for more on that.
All the different partners, including NOAA, and I'm not really sure how that works. I mean, NASA designs and builds these spectacular satellites, and NOAA helps to manage them, or how does all that work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Basically, NASA's job in the remote sensing business is to innovate, find the new approaches, demonstrate them, test them, and then once something is mature, we hand that off to NOAA. We continue to build the country's weather satellites, but NOAA will manage them. NOAA will make the retrievals to translate the data from the satellite into the real world information that people need. And so that is the hope. We're not quite there yet in having a NOAA greenhouse gas satellite, but we're working really hard to make that happen in the next decade. And I also want to acknowledge that while we're talking about NOAA, they do set the world standard for greenhouse gas measurements on the ground. The Mauna Loa measurements are the gold standard of measurements. And so, you know, that in combination with the satellite measurements, you need both of them. That is one of the most important advances that the U.S. has made to studying climate change.
Dr. Leslie Ott is a NASA client scientist with 20 years experience studying air pollution and greenhouse gases. We wish you continued success with your program.
Thank you very much.